when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I like the Pennin Kulma, which is a Finnish unit of distance that roughly translates as reindeer's piss.
That's very civilized.
It's how long a reindeer can walk before it needs to urinate.
Invented a second, and why is a second a second, and why is a kilogram, and what are we measuring 1 kilogram against? Welcome to Patented, a podcast all about the history of inventions from the fine folk at History Hit. I'm Dallas Campbell, and today I'm investigating the invention of standardized measurements. I'd always assumed that measurements were standardized no matter where you are in the world or when you are in history, even though measurements change. I'd always assumed they were standardized, but that is not the case. Standardized measurements, in fact, have a millennia-long and very interesting history, and today's guest, author and journalist James Vincent, argues that they are just as important as the written word for really understanding history, and particularly they're a source that we can use for understanding statehood and power and control through time. James is the author of Beyond Measure, The Hidden History of the Measurement, and I got a chance to talk to him today. James Vincent, welcome to the show. Congratulations on your book, which has been out for a couple of weeks.
Thank you so much for having me, Dallas.
It's a pleasure. It's great. I've been really, really enjoying it. It's just a pleasure to read because it's just nicely written.
Thank you. All the words in the right order.
That's my review over. It's one of those subjects, actually. I'm, like you, utterly fascinated by it. And I think the problem with discussions about measurements is they're so ubiquitous that we don't even think about it. It's invisible because it's so ubiquitous. It's only when you, like you and others, when you start drilling into, well, hang on a sec, how does this work, that you realise just how massively important it is, not just in a historical point of view, but just for all the human culture basically relies on our ability to measure.
Yeah, there's so many levels to it. This is what really sort of drew me to the subject, and that I initially came in with it with these questions, you know, quite basic ones like, why is an inch an inch? Why is a kilogram a kilogram? Who decides this? How does that get promulgated? Yeah. So there's like the practical side of it. Yeah. And then there's this deep conceptual side of it, which is like, deep. How did this shape us? Why as a civilization are we so obsessed with measurement? What have we got out of it? And what is it doing to us?
Well, I think it's not even an obsession. It's so utterly fundamental to the human, to being what it is to be. It kind of is what it is to be a human. Like, if we didn't have any measurement, then we wouldn't be able to, that's it. We wouldn't be humans.
I didn't know when writing the book how strongly to make this claim.
No, you can make it.
You think it's legit? Okay, I'm putting it out here then. Measurement is as important to human civilization as language or mathematics, in my opinion.
It is, in a way, it is language and mathematics. And hopefully in this discussion we will be able to sort of qualify our argument. I mean, actually, many years ago, I made a program about time. We did a thing about time dilation and sort of measuring time. And I got a bit like, well, I'll talk about kilograms in a minute, which was your entry point, I think, into the subject. But I got really into seconds and what a second was. We were doing Einstein's theory of relativity, and we were doing time dilation. So we had two atomic clocks, which measure time very, very accurately. And we took one round the world on an aeroplane. And then when we measured them back up, that one was slightly out.
How much was the gap?
I can't remember.
But like, we're talking slivers, up. Slivers.
A tiny amount. Right. It wasn't like a Back to the Future adventure set.
No.
I wasn't like erased from history, annoyingly. But it was one of those things. And I just became obsessed by the way that we measure and the history of measurement as well, which yeah. I think was what we're going to talk about here. Yeah. The trouble is it's such a massive subject. I don't know how we cram it all in.
Well, we'll give it a go. If we could send the podcast on some sort of trip, a plane yeah. around, send it to the moon and back, and then we'd have, you know, thanks to the wonders of time dilation, we'd have more time to talk about it all.
Well, exactly right. Well, I mean, this is a podcast really about origins. It's a podcast yeah. about how things start, and we kind of always start from that point of view. And actually, yeah. I've got your book in front of me. Actually, paragraph one. I shall read to you the very first measurement, like the first word or the first melody, is lost to time. Well, that's annoying, isn't it? Because I was going to ask.
It is.
Somewhere in our evolutionary past, do we have a point? You mentioned sort of notches on sticks or notches on bones, wolf bones, actually, in your introduction. Is that the yeah. first evidence we have that humans suddenly we wanted to quantify nature or kind of put nature in a box somehow? Those notches on sticks that we find.
I think it's the first tangible evidence we could have. I'm sure with a sort of speculative reading and an anthropological speculative bent, you could probably try and give a plausible account of how those ideas first came to spring up. But I think a key factor of measurement, what makes measurement measurement, is that it is an act of communication. So there needs to be a record in some sense, and there needs to be a way of sharing that information. So notches on bones is, I think, the best first account we might have of it.
That's really interesting, because it's kind of, and there's also the history of kind of five notches of notch, and then a line through it, like in yes. kind of cartoon prison sequences when they're yeah. counting the days that they're in prison. It's odd. Yeah. Why is that a thing? Like kind of counting in five.
So I couldn't find any sort of explanation for that, and I think it's the sort of thing where I don't know how you tend to approach these subjects, but whenever I start on something like this, I really want to know where the first thing happens. And there are some things, I think, in human history and human science, history of technology, where actually you come up against something that might just be biologically innate. And I'm not a great believer in biological innateness in general. I think it's often a shadow of some other effect, and we want to get onto it. In the case of the notches, so there's psychological studies I found that suggested that this is some sort of a biological limit in the human brain, in that when we tend to, psychologists call it subitizing, which is when you take in a number of things at a glance, and the human limit for that is 4 or 5, basically. But the limit in closely related species, like chimpanzees, is much, much greater.
Oh my God, there's that thing that you said, and I seem to remember seeing this somewhere else as well, like you can yeah. sort of flash up numbers 1 to 10 on a screen, like 1 to yeah. 10 or different... Yeah. A bit like that game Pelmanism, when you have to remember where the card is. You know, or you have a tray of
yeah.
objects, you have to remember where they are. You do that with a chimpanzee, and they can yeah. instantly recall where the numbers 1 to 10 in order are. Like much faster than humans, but then that's the sort yeah. of limit of their cognitive ability.
The weird thing about that is it's faster than humans by a huge degree, but it's also faster than their eye can move. So it's sort of they're taking it in their peripheral vision, essentially, yeah. and they have this eidetic memory for certain
What's
patterns.
It called? Eidetic memory.
Eidetic, well, yeah, well, you know, when you remember everything, you don't forget anything. I think that's an eidetic memory, isn't it?
Yeah, well, that's you've written it that way. It's a word I wasn't familiar with, so I'm going with this. I like it.
But the thing is, and again, this is sort of quite speculative, because who knows how chimpanzees are processing this information exactly, but from the tests we've done, it sort of suggests that, you know, they really don't have any greater understanding. They can't really number things and count stuff, but they can recognize a pattern and remember it. And yeah. the hypothesis is that at some point our ancestors had that skill and we swapped it for other cognitive abilities.
Wow, oh, that's
including communication and, you know, social abilities.
Yeah. Okay, so when do you think this... So when did we first start putting notches on things? When did we first
yes.
get a ruler out and started measuring nature?
The notches that we have, and again, speculative, we don't quite know what they were being used for, but basically we have these ancient bones, some of them about 30,000 years old, 20,000 years old about this. There's the wolf bone of Czechoslovakia, there's the Ashango bone, which I think is a baboon fibula. And yes, they have these notches on them, and we think they are so well ordered that there has to be some purpose behind that, and we think it may be counting, and it could have been counting, again, speculative, the phases of the moon. because they tend to group around 30 notches, which would have been one of the first cycles that would have been most apparent to human observers. And I think that is really where measurement comes from, in that it comes from the cycles of nature. And we start counting those cycles.
It was a Thursday, I'm going to just say.
Right, yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. Well, there is, I mean, the cycles of nature, and of course, you know, you take us back in time to the Sumerians and the Babylonians and the Egyptians. Yeah. And of course, you think about the Nile, as the sort of cycles of the Nile in terms of flooding and oh God, we could go so deep into this. I'm trying to sort of narrow the topics down. Otherwise,
of course, we can skip ahead to the ancient Egyptians if you like.
Rabbit hole is too deep. Why do you think measurement is important for understanding our history? There you go. That's my question one for you. Because you talk a lot about control and power, and I'm really interested in how that has shaped history.
Because I think measurement has been an incredible tool for the state, and for what we would think of, I guess, as, you know, proto-states, statelets, you know, anywhere where there is a settled civilization. And I think this comes back to what I said earlier about measurement being a tool of communication. And I'm ripping off there a great historian of science named Theodore Porter. And he's talking about quantification in general, but he calls them technologies of distance, in that they allow you to communicate across time and space. And within the function of a state, that allows you to sort of share knowledge across distant geographies. So that's useful for trade, that's useful for the tectonic arcs, so building, architecture, whether that's ramparts or granaries, whatever it might be. And it's also useful for the state for sort of having some insight into the activities of its citizens. Although that doesn't become important or doesn't become quite so prominent until we get into sort of the early modern period from, you know, 1200 onwards, where we start to see the emergence of more centralized states. Yeah, you mentioned the ancient Egyptians.
Yes.
And that was one of my sort of favorite discoveries that, you know, I made for myself during the book. I didn't discover this, but I hadn't heard about it before. And this was this thing called the Nilometer, which is an artifact used by the ancient Egyptians to measure the depth of the Nile's floods each year. So flooding, obviously incredibly important to the ancient Egyptian state, agricultural economy. The floods deliver the fertile plains that they, you know, need to grow their crops on. So in order to predict when how good these floods were going to be, they created Nilometers, which are essentially big rulers that they stuck in the Nile and that they measured the depth of the flooding with them each year. And they used that to predict what the state would need to do in the following year. Because if it was a great flood, then you knew that you were going to have a bountiful harvest. Everyone was going to be happy. If you saw that there was a bad flood coming, there wasn't going to be enough water, then you'd have to prepare for it. So this is measurement as a tool for predicting the future.
There you go.
Controlling the state.
Yeah, so we measure in order to make models, in order to understand what the world is going to be like in the future. So this is a very human thing. This implies forethought. It implies cognitive ability that can think in terms
of planning.
In terms of the future. Actually, the interesting thing, the Nilometer is an interesting idea, because in your book, there's loads of examples of just like bonkers measurement standards. It's so normal to think of measuring as sort of ubiquitous in terms of there is a standard kilogram and a kilogram is the same here as it is there. But actually, that is a relatively modern thing, because Nilometer is a measurement of in the ancient Egyptians is going to be different to a measurement perhaps in the Roman world.
Yeah, although there is actually, between the Egyptians and the Romans, because, you know, there's obviously a lot of shared knowledge between them in terms of astronomy. But there is usually huge amounts of disjuncture between political powers. It's not. It's never quite so clean cut as being like, well, this country took over and then it had its measurements, and then another country took over and it had its measurements, because there's always a lot of inheritance and I guess development. So, you know, you bring up the Romans, for example. They had a fantastically rigorous system of measurement. And we still, you know, the effects of that were felt throughout Europe for, you know, millennia later, in that their basis of weight was the libra ponda. And we now have the pound in England. You know, in Germany, it's the pfund. In the Netherlands, it's the pond. In Italy, it's the libra. And so you see how these things are sort of seeded. And if they're useful, they're often kept for quite a long time.
What are some, give us, because there's a few kind of pretty crazy sort of units of measurement which we just don't have anymore, like the way that cows eat grass.
Yes.
What was that one called again? I can't remember what that one's called.
I think, this was the collop, I think.
Yeah, the collop, that's the one, yes.
Yes. Exactly. So this was an old Irish unit of measurement.
Yeah.
And the collop was, the amount of land needed to graze a single cow for a day.
So rather than a measurement of acre, it's a much more useful measurement in terms of actually how productive an area of land is rather than the actual boundaries of things.
Yeah, because say you're selling someone, a kilometre squared of land and you're selling it sight unseen, you don't know what it's like. And say you're a farmer and you need to know that it's got to be there to support your crops.
Yeah.
It could be a barren hillside. It could be the nicest pasture you've ever seen. It could be a piece of rock. Could be nothing. Could be everything. So a collop is a unit that, as you say, encodes this information that is particular to the life and to the labour of these individuals.
That's really sensible. Do we have anything like that anymore?
I think we still have ad hoc measurements of a sort. The thing is that these flexible measurements, if you want to call them that, perhaps, they got overtaken and they got outcompeted by very abstract, unchanging, consistent units of measurement, the metric system being the
We're going to come on to that in a minute.
We'll come on to that. But I was actually thinking, I've been thinking about this, obviously, for a while now.
You have. You've written a really very good book about it. So.
But I think we do have sort of ad hoc measurements, but then they're not formalised in the same way. So you might think to yourself, I've got a journey to take. That's going to be two podcasts length, and that's not a strict unit of time, but
that makes me really happy, because actually we think of these abstract measurements as a bit sort of arcane and ridiculous,
like that one,
but actually no, we measure things in terms of Olympic swimming pools and whales.
I really like phone batteries. I was thinking about this the other day, in that you sort of estimate sometimes how much phone battery you've got left to give, and like, do I need to do this before recharging? And it's sort of it's a really flexible, weird unit of time that relates to your personal understanding of your phone and what it's going to do. And I don't know, I think we come up with a lot of these, basically.
You're right.
Without thinking.
Podcast is quite a good one. I've started to use podcasts as a kind of measurement system in my brain. Yeah. The trouble is they're so random in terms of length. My podcasts are relatively short. This one's kind of half an hour. Actually, this one might be a bit longer, I think. We'll be back after this short break.
Hi there. I'm Kate Lister, sex historian and author. And I am the host of Betwixt the Sheets, the history of sex, scandal and society, a new podcast from History Hit. Join me as I root around the topics which have been skipped over in your school history lessons. Everything from the history of swearing to pubic hair, satanic panic, cults, there is nothing off limits. We'll be bed hopping around different time periods, from ancient civilizations to the Middle Ages to Renaissance and early modern, right up to now. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I think that the thing that you, actually you mentioned it again at the beginning, that you got into this because of the redefinition of the kilogram. So I thought I just might just sort of talk about that because I don't know if people know that. So something like the second, there is a mathematical function behind why a second is a second. You know, people can Google that. But a kilogram itself was always an artifact. There was a lump of metal in a vault in Paris called Le Grand Quai, which I remember, in a sort of glass bell jar. And that was the standard kilogram. And everything was measured off that bit of metal. Now, of course, it's going to gain weight and it's going to lose weight, even though it's protected, but it's not going to be very precise. So they quite recently, they recalibrated it by using a constant of nature, Planck constant.
Yeah.
And you got involved in that. Did you kind of go over while they were this great sort of switchover was happening?
I went over there in 2018 when they were first, they did the official vote on it, and then the sort of changing of the guard happened in 2019, I think it was March or something.
So what was the vote? It was between a Planck constant in nature and something else, and I can't remember what it was.
So there was an alternate method, which was to do with counting the mole.
Not the animal.
No, not the animal. No,
the atoms in some carbon, I think.
Exactly. Well, in a perfectly spherical
doodah
thing. Yeah, which was an amazing in itself. But they sort of, it was one of those things where, you know, there's so much work that's gone into it that actually all the questions about it had been settled well in advance. And the ceremony that I went to see was really everyone congratulating one another on a fantastic job that they'd done. But it was very moving.
The thing, no one's going to know. Like, nobody beyond the weights and measures people are going to know that we no longer measure it from an artifact. We actually measure it from some maths instead.
This is what the scientists said to me. They said, if we do our job rightly, no one will notice. And that's how they felt about these things. You know, they're sort of like, I don't know, I imagine them as some sort of like invisible secret superhero team, which is my romanticised idea of scientists perhaps, but you know, working in the background to maintain essentially one of the most important struts that upholds modern civilization, the metric system. And it really is.
It's an amazing thing, but I love for a long time I've been fascinated by Le Grand Quai. I've been fascinated by the, because I love things, I love objects, and I love the fact that we measure things by, you know, the ruler, which is exactly a meter long, that's in Paris, and the lump of metal. But now it's all just kind of mathematics and much more accurate. Well, it makes sense. You kind of need it to be.
You know, I had mixed feelings about it. So one slight correction I will say is that there were actually two lumps of metal. One was the kilogram of the archives, as it's now called, which was originally done during the creation of the metric system. And then they replaced that about a century later, I think 1888 or something like that, with Le Grand Quai, the international prototype kilogram, which was actually forged by a British firm, because we did the best metallurgy at this point in time. So, you know, despite the desire by some UK residents to distance themselves from the metric system, actually we've been involved in its creation since the very beginning.
That's a good... I want to ask you about that. Okay, so basically anything that involves invention or something either comes down to Edison or the French Revolution.
Okay.
If we're talking about measurement, at some point we have to talk about how it all became standardised. Because there's no point in having measurement if everyone measures things differently and people were measuring things differently, a hand, horsepower, whatever it is. So when did the metric system come about, cue the French Revolution?
The metric system came about as pressures in France, which were both practical, and desires in France, which were ideological, is how I think about it. So, you know, you have this system. We've skipped off a lot of history from the ancient Egyptians to the French Revolution.
We have.
But
you want to?
I'll fill in a little bit of it. So you have obviously countries and states realize that standardizing units of measurement to be used by their people is very, very important because it is useful for trade, it's useful for building, and it's useful to keep people happy. So there's this great pressure to create standardized units of measurement, and there's great privilege and power associated with being in control of that. In France, this creates a problem in part because in Ancien Régime France, a lot of power is devolved to the nobility in various ways. And they end up setting standards that are specific to their province or their town or whatever their, you know, their sphere of influence is. And this is one of the reasons that France is tormented by variations of units. There's this great account by a visiting English agriculturist called Arthur Young, who goes over in the years before the revolution to see how France's economy is doing, basically. And he talks about the tormenting perplexities of the French system of measurement and how you could go from one town to the next and the same unit would be used, but it would have a value that was maybe 100%, 150% different in its capacity. So there's the pint, for example, and that differs from 0.8 litres in one town to 3 litres in another town. This creates confusion.
Annoying,
and this creates anger. Yeah.
Well, also things like time in Britain, you know, the railways, we had different time zones in Britain.
We did.
And just like crazy stuff like that, which seems bonkers now. Well, it is bonkers.
But this is what measurements do. And I think the time railway stuff is a great example of that I now wish I'd put in the book, is that it knits together time and space and it unifies what might be a disparate geography into a single cohesive unit. So this was the practical inducement for the French revolutionaries to create a consistent system of units that was the same throughout France, because they thought it would really help the economy.
When they're having their revolution, how high on the list of priorities? Is there other thing, or we've got to kill the king, you know, we want to become a republic. Like, where was kind of weights and measures on that kind of list of, stuff to do?
Well, actually, wonderfully, we have a really good idea of how high up the list it was because of this document called the Cahier de Doléances, which was a sort of survey of the discontent of France created by the Third Estate. They sent out questionnaires basically to all the towns, and they were like, what really pisses you off today? And they got this list back, and weights and measures, I can't remember the exact number, and it's in the book somewhere, but it was 20s to 30s basically. In this list of hundreds, so it was pretty high up. There was this slogan at the time, which was one king, one law, one weight, one measure. So it was enough that it became a rallying point because people felt that they were being cheated.
And presumably, like Napoleon, who loved science, you know, he had his group of scientists that he would travel. And I think of Napoleon going to Egypt with his scientists and measuring Egypt and sort of trying to understand this sort of civilization. So it was, I guess, kind of embedded in that particular culture. Did it kind of spread? They sort of said, right, we're going to have this standardization of weights and measures. Did that spread naturally throughout the rest of the world?
It had been something that had sort of been on the cards before this. Scientists had been talking about it for a while, that it would really benefit humanity if we had this. So there was some natural favorability towards it. There were many reasons that the metric system was sort of objected to in the US and the UK particularly. And one of them was the definition of the meter, which was 1/10 millionth of the distance from the equator to the North Pole. And it was based on this survey measuring the Paris meridian. But at the time, it was not sort of clear whether the meridian was the same, whether the Earth was a perfect sphere. And it turns out that it's not. So that meant that the meridian could only be the Paris one. Anyway, so
that's interesting. Could you actually tell us what I sort of talk about the metric system. We all sort of understand roughly.
Yeah.
What did it mean at the time, the metric system? Like, what was the sort of thought behind, you know, you mentioned distance there. What about things like weight? Why is a kilogram a kilogram?
A big thing was that the units would be interconnected, that they would be dependent on one another. I guess there's three big characteristics of the metric system. The first is that it had new names and prefixes. The second was that it was decimal, that it was base 10 rather than base 12 or 16, that was common for a lot of other systems of measurement.
And was there a reason why they wanted base 10? Like, why, if we'd been thinking in terms of ounces and 12s and 16s, why 10? Like, what was it?
Well, there were a lot of scientists involved in its creation, and they were prejudiced or they were biased towards it, and they thought the decimal system was going to be something that would educate the masses, that it was a more useful system when it came to calculating in very large and very small numbers. It obviously allows for easy conversions by just moving the decimal point. So you could switch between units and spans quite quickly. And they thought that it would be something that would be like teaching everyone in your country how to speak another language or something like that. They thought it would help, and there's a quote, I think, which would help make citizens self-sufficient in their own calculations. So it would help people understand their own personal accounts better. So there was they thought it would be improving for people. And the interconnectedness of the units, that was the other thing, is that you take the meter, and then you would take a cube made from the meter, from a decimeter, and then you would fill that with water, and then that would be the kilogram. So that you'd be able to create one unit from the other units.
And was there a kind of It wasn't like an instant switchover, you know, when I think in Sweden they suddenly started driving on the other side of the road after midnight.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, right, this is it, as on Tuesday we're going metric.
It was introduced in this sort of quite dramatic fashion because it was the French Revolution and they were all in for the big upheavals of society. But there was, as you suggest, a lot of resistance to it and a lot of old units that got used. And you mentioned Napoleon earlier. So obviously he takes over at one point and yes, he starts spreading the metric system all around Europe and imposing it on some countries. And some are actually very annoyed about this and some are actually quite grateful because they are aware of the inadequacies of their own system. And it's quite nice sometimes to have someone go in and go, right, we're getting rid of that and you have to use this and there's going to be no complaint. It's one of those things that's sort of easier in tyranny than it is in democracy, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But because of this, actually, the difficulties of introducing it, France is not only the first country to adopt the metric system, it's the first country to reject it. And Napoleon gets rid of metric measures and he creates this sort of compromise system called mesure usuelle, where he gets the old names and he sort of updates some of their values because people were getting frustrated by it. And Napoleon said that the metric system was tormenting people with trivia, that they had to remember too many names and too many prefixes. But one, he'd spread it over the European continent, it took root and a lot of people started using it and seeing it as the superior system that should be adopted everywhere.
Why not in America? Why is America still, particularly America, still so, yeah, we don't have the metric system here. They still talk about it like, I'm like, what? It seems so crazy.
There's a few reasons. One of them is that they thought it was too French. They thought because the meter was based on the Paris meridian, they thought, you know, that Jefferson was talking about this.
Yeah.
But it's sort of understandable. There is a lot of straightforward xenophobia in dislike of the metric system. And because it's associated with the excesses of the revolution, people start talking about it as this unnatural imposition, as this atheistic, you know, blood-curdling, you know, destruction of the natural order. That is part of it. But the big thing for America is that America is a big thing, in that their economy is so large that they don't really need to change to a new system. And that's also true of the UK. Because we had the British Empire, we had a huge internal market, that the idea of sort of adopting what everyone else is doing in order to harmonise trade with them wasn't actually needed for us. Obviously, we're in a very different situation now. A little bit of harmonised trade with the rest of the world would go down nicely.
It's interesting, though, how these, you know, cultural things still play on. And you know, we like to have our own little systems, as you describe. But actually, if you're doing science, if you really want to understand how nature works properly, you've got to have a unified system and a system that we all agree on. I think that wasn't there a famous case where they sent a probe to Mars and some of them were doing it in inches and some of them were doing it in millimetres and the whole thing.
And it blew up.
Or was that an apocryphal story? I don't know, actually.
No, that genuinely true. There was a full NASA investigation into it and it was not to do with inches. It was something to do with capacity measures, I believe, in terms of calculating the fuel burn rate. And it wasn't that it necessarily blew up, but they got the trajectory wrong for the entry into the Mars atmosphere and it bounced off and blithered away into space, but lost millions and millions of dollars because of it.
You mentioned our current situation. There seems to be a lot of politics wrapped up in measurements and who controls measurements and who decides the way we do things. Historically, have kind of governments used measurements as a way of controlling people, or a way of asserting dominance, if you like, or political power?
Yeah, they have. I mean, the thing is that measurement really is wrapped up in political sovereignty. Measurement becomes wrapped up with ideas of national strength. And in the US and the UK particularly, there is this movement in the 19th century where it's seen as an imposition of a foreign order. And it's really interesting because you see a lot of strands emerge that are really resonant still today. So you have people talking about the new world order that is going to be imposed upon people. And it starts with measurement.
Yes. Yeah, there is that sort of libertarian sort of backlash against that sort of idea.
Yeah, yeah.
But I suppose we see it, you know, much closer to home with Brexit. We're starting to see a kind of pushback against, I read, so, oh, we're going to have pints on pint glasses again.
There was a poll done by YouGov and it was of people who had voted for Brexit. And it was, what do you want to see returned? And I can't remember the exact order, but there was, you know, there was six or so items listed in the poll. And they included the return of blue passports, the return of imperial units of measure, and bring back hanging. Those were the demands. Those were what people were most looking forward to, apparently. That's crazy. But it's so it is a nostalgia project. But I actually think Weights and Measures has really been part of Brexiteers' campaign for a long time. Do you know the case of the Metric Martyrs?
No.
So Metric Martyrs were in a group of traders, sort of vegetable, you know, grocery traders, market stall traders, in 2000, 2001, who got prosecuted for not using the correct units of weight and measure on their stalls. They weren't prosecuted for using imperial. They were prosecuted for not offering metric as an option. They had to do both. That was what the law required, and they only wanted to do imperial. And they became a bit of a cause célèbre. You look at the sort of early press scrum that happened around these individuals, and Nigel Farage is there. And he is fulminating about how this case shows that, you know, the UK can no longer decide its future. We are being controlled by bureaucrats from the EU who are taking away our heritage. And there's a really fascinating piece by, I think, former BBC politics editor, who said he describes this case as the starting gun for Brexit, because it was the moment where people saw what was happening, or they thought they did anyway.
Well, that's what, I mean, I would argue, you know, Brexit has nothing to do with facts. It's nothing to do with we're going to be better here. It's everything to do with culture, with our culture and how we see the world and how we see our position in the world and our history and everything else. Hey, listen, we're kind of, crikey, we're running out of time. Just very quickly, as a sort of little end point, do you have a favourite measurement? I'm obsessed by collecting odd measurements now. And your cow one from Ireland, what's it called again?
The collop.
Collop might be my new favourite.
C-O-L-L-O-P.
Do you have a favourite that we should go back to?
I like the peninkulma, which is a Finnish unit of distance that roughly translates as reindeer's piss.
That's very civilised. Pissing context.
It's how long a reindeer can walk before it needs to urinate.
In my case, it's very short because I'm a middle-aged man. Right. So I...
a Dallas piss. Don't we invent that as a new unit of measurement today?
We
inaugurate it.
It's about a
mile. Is it?
Yeah.
Great.
And then I need to go.
Well, that makes it easy. We can just change the units on the signposts. We don't need to worry about anything like that.
I'll draw it. I'm good at drawing such things. Okay. James, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk. I could talk all day. Your book is out. And also, your book's got a lovely... I've actually taken the dust jacket off your book because I noticed along the side there's a cunning ruler.
There is a ruler on the spine.
Beyond Measure, James Vincent. It's out now. It's beautiful and it's beautifully written and it's fascinating. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Dallas. Really enjoyed this.
Okay, that is it for this episode. Thanks very much for listening. If you want to hear more from our guest, I thoroughly recommend his book, Beyond Measure. It's out now. And if you've enjoyed today's episode, please don't forget to leave a rating and a review. It helps others discover the show. Don't forget as well, if you want me to investigate a particular invention or a thing, an artifact or an idea that has a beginning, get in touch and we will stick it on our list. Next up on the next episode, we have a discussion about the invention of baby formula. So if you have a new baby and you use formula and you've wondered, where on earth does baby formula come from? Who came up with that idea? Don't forget to tune in. It's a really, really fascinating story. I look forward to your company then.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
While I still have you, very briefly, if you fancy getting all of the History Hit podcast archive and new episodes ad-free, along with hundreds of history documentaries to watch, download our app across Apple App Store, Google Play, and smart TV platforms. Follow the link in the show notes or go to historyhit.com/subscribe. There is thousands of hours of history on there, including a documentary on science in the Middle Ages with Seb Volk, and also one with me talking about the secret history of the space race. As a patented listener, you get a special gift if you use the code PATENTED at the checkout. You get 50% off your first 3 months. That's PATENTED for 50% off your first 3 months. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free podcast episodes within the Apple app.